That's the Mingus Band with Charles Mingus's all-time classic, Haitian Fight Song. It's from the 1999 album, Blues and Politics. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and our music intro today gives a hint of where we will be going first in this first half of the program, and that is to Haiti. It was to be a raucous Mardi Gras in Haiti today, the annual carnival celebration coinciding with the election of a new president. Instead, a somber mood envelops the country. Michel Martelly, the singer that Hillary Clinton helped install as president, left office on February the 7th and left behind postponed elections, a now leaderless country, violence and turmoil in the streets, and the legacy of corruption that harkens back to the Duvalier regime of some 30 years ago. We are fortunate to have Kim Ives with us. He is the editor of Haiti Liberté, a newspaper and an online a new service that serves the Haitian diaspora. He has been our correspondent about things Haitian, and especially Haitian politics, providing, I think, some of the best insights and coverage anywhere on the subject. And I thank you, Kim, for being with us. The last time we talked, you talked with us from site, on site in the Dominican Republic and in Haiti. What's the current situation in the aftermath of the departure of Michel Martelly?
Well, yeah, it's always a pleasure to be on your show, Eutrice. About every 30 years, Haiti seems to have one of these spasms, political spasms. In 1956, the dictatorship of General Paul Magloire fell. And there was a year or two of provisional governments. In 1986, it was the dictatorship of Jean-Claude Duvalier, which fell. And there were about 4 years of provisional governments and coup d'etats until the election in 1990 of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. And now, 30 years after that February 7th departure of Jean-Claude Duvalier, we see the fall of Haiti's first neo-Duvalierist president since then, or elected, quote-unquote elected neo-Duvalierist president, Joseph Michel Martelly, who left power on February 7th in the face of essentially a mass uprising. And I could say the fact that the U.S. Empire, which put him in place, more or less, began to see that he was no longer really an asset, but had become something of a liability. And unfortunately, the sort of scenario they'd been trying to engineer, which was to have a kind of selection election, as the Haitians call it, of the Martelly candidate, a fellow called Jovenel Moïse, against the candidate of a party called La Paix, which is affiliated with former President René Préval. This runoff couldn't happen because of that uprising, because thousands were in the street on January 22nd, as we talked about in your last program, and because Jude Celestin, the Préval-affiliated candidate, refused to go into that second round. So now Haiti has no president. It has an interim prime minister, a fellow called Evans Paul, or Caplume, Compe Plume. That's his name when he was a playwright back 3 decades ago. And Compe Plume will be the prime minister until supposedly a new interim president is in prime minister as well, are established by the parliament, and then elections would theoretically be held, even though this is just purely in the air because no electoral council has established it, on April 24th so that power could be passed on May 14th, which was the date in 2011 when Martelly came into power. So we're apparently, Utrice, in one of these periods of high instability. There's going to be several provisional governments, I'm sure, because the entire opposition in the street are not at all agreed that this parliament appoint and choose the presidency and the prime minister and the leadership of the country, because they themselves are tainted by these same elections, which were completely awash in fraud and corruption and violence.
We also have to make it very clear, again, this is Hillary Clinton's, she has a hand, a direct hand in this, and she is being allowed to, of course, nothing is rubbing off on her, and the coverage of Haiti's elections and the ensuing violence and the chaos here with Martelly leaving, none of this seems to be rubbing off on her, although this candidate, the one who just is leaving office now, is her handpicked candidate, and there was, in fact, a rigged election that put him in. She personally saw to it that he was elected.
Exactly. That was, just to review for the listeners, and I think we've covered this once or twice before, but it bears restating. In 2010, on November 28th, the election held under then-President René Préval was a total mess, and all the candidates, including Michel Martelly and Mirland Maniga, went and held a big press conference, and they said this election was a joke, it's a mess, it's impossible to go forward, and it has to be redone. Everybody was agreed. Excuse me. And then Martelly and Mirland Maniga got phone calls from the head of the UN peacekeeping, quote-unquote, peacekeeping force, a fellow called, and I don't know why his name's escaping me right now, a Guatemalan diplomat, who called them and said, no, you're going to be in the runoff, so you can't kick this election to the curb. You've got to stay in it. And so these two pulled back, and a couple of weeks later, on January 30th, 2011, in the middle of the uprising in Egypt, Hillary Clinton flew to Haiti and essentially read the riot act to Préval and said, listen, your candidate, who the sovereign political provisional electoral council, or CEP, of Haiti had found to be in the runoff with Mirland Maniga, he was dumped, and an OAS supposed fact-finding delegation came, and then a completely unscientific and a statistically verifiable way said Celestin is out, and Martelly, who came in number three supposedly, is in. And this way, Martelly got into the runoff and then proceeded to win the election. So it was completely overriding the Provisional Electoral Council of Haiti, which is constitutionally the final arbiter of any election. So, we saw what Ricardo Seitenfuss of the OAS observer team called himself an electoral coup d'etat, and this was essentially facilitated by Hillary Clinton.
So now we have no leader for this country. It's without a leader. It is without an election, mm-hmm. not until April 24th, with the possibility, that's just, if things go right until then, there will be a provisional government. One wonders what shape that would be. And mm-hmm. we have violence increasing in the streets. What is the mood right now in Haiti in the midst of all of this?
The mood is one of great tension, great dissatisfaction. Essentially, the call from the street, Utrice, is for those elections to be completely annulled, for them to be thrown out. They don't want Compe Plume or Evans Paul as prime minister. They don't want the parliament there. They want to start from scratch. And they want the UN peacekeeping mission called MINUSTAH. They want them out of the country. They don't want foreigners meddling in Haitian affairs anymore. And finally, they want the popular organizations, the base organizations, to be part of forming whatever sort of provisional government comes into play, not these fraudulently elected parliamentarians, not the bourgeoisie of Haiti, who, of course, is in the back rooms pulling strings and giving money under the table. So the streets are very angry. We're in really a revolutionary moment, I think, where the street is way ahead of the politicians, even the candidates in this election. They're trying to conserve it because a lot of them think they won in the first or second round on August 9th or October 25th. And they want a verification commission to come in and review the electoral results. But the people have no patience for this. They don't want that. They say, you know, just throw the whole damn thing out and let's start from scratch with a good electoral council and without the foreign meddling, which basically has skewed this election in ways that the people are unhappy with. So the street is angry. We can expect a lot more demonstrations and, unfortunately, more killings because the sources that we have on the ground, I was looking at some of them today, the government is essentially forming death squads, the old neo-devaluerist old guard is forming death squads to counter this mass uprising with killings and terror that will keep people off the streets and try to intimidate them. I think it could end up being counterproductive, however.
Well, speaking of foreign interference, to what degree are the Clintons' hands still being shown in the current situation in Haiti? And what about the role of the Organization of American States? That organization seemed to have come under suspicion as well. Could you speak to those two things?
Yes. Well, the OAS, I should say that the Clintons have been hiding, I could say. Bill Clinton got a lot of political capital in 1994 when he became the first and last American president to return to power a victim of a U.S.-backed coup d'etat. That is, George H.W. Bush basically backed the coup d'etat against Jean-Bertrand Aristide in 1991, September 30th, 1991. And after 3 years of demonstrations in the streets of Haiti, as well as the Haitian diaspora in the United States, Canada, France, they felt, well, we got to bring him back. But they brought him back basically surrounded by 20,000 U.S. troops who were enforcing an agenda which was essentially the neoliberal reform of Haiti's economy. Aristide paid lip service to this and said, okay, I'll do your reforms, but he did not. He basically dragged his feet and found ways to undermine that. They got very mad with him and pushed him right out the door in 1996 to get rid of him, even though he and many of the Haitian people had wanted him to recoup the 3 years he'd spent in exile. So, in short, the the OAS, to return to that question, has played a role throughout this whole period as sort of the observer, the enforcer. It is, as I think we've said on your show before, what Cuba calls Washington's Ministry of Colonial Affairs. And so they have been in Haiti, coming in, trying to pressure various politicians to go along, find some sort of compromise. But, you know, the people really don't want the OAS involved. They say, please, go away. You are not helping the situation. We have to remember that it was under the banner of the OAS that U.S. Marines intervened 50 years ago in the Dominican Republic next door to Haiti and killed thousands of Dominicans in trying to put down a Cuban-style uprising, armed uprising, led by Caimano, who they ended up killing. And so the OAS is very much unwelcome in Haiti and has been trying to play this role of, we could say, intermediary, but it's not working.
Well, what is happening now? I mean, it seems like it's a standstill, but I know there are things that are happening behind the scenes. Does it look like the elections that are set for April the 24th will actually take place by then? And what is to be the nature of this interim government?
I don't think it's going to happen on the time frame they're hoping. I mean, these are completely arbitrary dates that they're picking. And if history is any guide, this is going to go on for many months, if not years, of basically political turmoil. I mean, what we have to see, Utrice, is essentially these are two historical currents who are confronting each other over the past several decades. You have the democratic push coming from the grassroots organizations, from the peasants, the workers, the unemployed in the cities, who want to have sovereignty, who want to have their justice and freedom back, which they haven't seen in many decades. And this desire, I could say, has been represented with the emergence of Jean-Bertrand Aristide in 1990 and René Préval, who was his first prime minister and ended up becoming the other alternating president, because it was first Aristide, then Préval, then Aristide, then Préval over the past 20 years. A Haitian presidential term is 5 years. So essentially, after the earthquake in 2010, the U.S. and I think the Haitian ruling groups saw an opportunity to really, you know, come back and retake power. And that's how they came with the opposing faction to this democratic surge of the neo-devaluerist groups, which are coalesced around Michel Martelly and his confederates. So the Martelly experiment or the attempt did not go very well, because essentially Martelly is practically a photocopy, we could say, of Jean-Claude Duvalier and his regime. They came with the same program, with the $13 billion of foreign aid, both from individuals and governments and institutions that Haiti got. They spent it doing what? Building sweatshops and tourism. This was the program of Jean-Claude Duvalier. They even used the same slogan that the Jean-Claudeists had, which was Haiti is open for business. Well, it didn't go very well for Jean-Claude, and it didn't go very well for Martelly either. And plus the fact that Martelly's government had really crazy amounts of excesses in terms of corruption, repression, its arbitrariness. People were disgusted also with the decrees that were made totally with no legal foundation, taxing money transfers coming into the country, taking over islands off the coast with a decree. So, you know, he thought he could be the king of Haiti or something like this. So this is really a response to this, I could say, U.S. Haitian elite push to retake Haiti's political direction from the democratic movement. The one last thing I would say about that, Utrice, is that people really saw the limits, though, of just a political revolution like that, which happened in 1990 with the election of Aristide. Because Aristide and Préval, Aristide was sort of hobbled and unable to get much done, really. And Préval really ended up sort of bowing to U.S. pressure and ended up becoming some sort of U.S. collaborator on a lot of the reforms they wanted to see. So the people said, you know, we have to go farther. We need really a social revolution where we change the basic ownership of the country in terms of land, in terms of the factories, in terms of, you know, how things are done, that eventually the bourgeoisie of Haiti and the U.S. will take back the government if the foundation, the economic foundation of government isn't changed.
So in this time of crisis, where is the pressure coming from with respect to the expatriate Haitian community? Is it coming from Paris? Is it coming from Canada? Is it coming from the U.S.? Where is it coming from?
The pressure is coming from, in terms of the expatriate community, majority of Haitians in the diaspora, I could say, are pushing for political change along the lines that the Haitian masses in the streets are pushing for. And I just realized with that question that I didn't really finish my thought with respect to the Clintons in your previous question. I was saying that Bill Clinton had gotten a lot of political capital when he brought back Aristide in 1994 and basically squandered that over the years by being the head of various UN commissions and so forth to rebuild Haiti, in particular the last one after the earthquake, the Interim Haiti Reconstruction Commission, or IHRC, which basically supported this Jean-Claudeist, this neo-devaluerist agenda of sweatshops and tourism. So he basically lost any last shred of credibility that he had when he said in December 2014, as Martelly's prime minister, Laurent Lamothe, was being chased from power, that, oh my goodness, you people are making a big mistake. This is the best prime minister you ever had. And after that, the people just said, you know, forget you, Clinton. So a lot of what the expatriate community is doing, in fact, in New York, is demonstrating outside the Clinton Foundation headquarters, saying, Bill Clinton, stay out of Haiti, you know, stop meddling, et cetera. So in the expatriate community, particularly in New York, there's a lot of pushback for the U.S., in particular Bill Clinton, not to meddle in Haiti. But I could say, on the other hand, you know, you have these sort of Haitian American elite, of which Martelly is kind of an example. Here's a guy who was a compa singer, kind of a compa star, going back and forth, spending most of his time in Miami with a band, going back and forth. They're kind of sometimes moving drugs back and forth, as well as their music. And, you know, a lot of these people are looking to remake Haiti in a along the lines of the Dominican Republic or Puerto Rico, kind of get more foreign investment, get more fancy hotel complexes or roads or whatever. I mean, all those roads are fine, but they want to do it under sort of a U.S. aegis. So there is a struggle replicated in the diaspora, the same struggle that we see going on in Haiti. But I think that for sure the majority of the population is looking to reclaim Haitian sovereignty, because, you know, this is very dear. This is the essence, I could say, of the Haitian identity, is that deep, deep pride in the sovereignty, in the national independence that they forged back in 1804, and was a touchstone for the independence movements throughout Latin America.
So as we close out the segment, I wanted to ask, what should we look for as a key clue to where things are going within, say, the next week or so?
Oh boy, that's a $64,000 question, because I think essentially watch what is happening in the streets. Right now, Haiti is being led by the streets. What you see in the government, in the besieged embassies and parliament, etc., is a reaction. How do we keep the people at bay? We see yesterday Evans Paul, the prime minister, saying, okay, you can stand down the mobilization. The people can get out of the streets, because right now all your demands are on the table of the state institutions. In other words, you know, we are now going to take up all your demands and you can stop demonstrating. And I don't think that people will buy it. I think we're going to continue to see these outpourings. It reminds me so much of 30 years ago, after Duvalier fell. The U.S. came in the same way, and they set up what they called the Council for National Government, the CNG. And every week, every month, it became a struggle against the sort of measures of the CNG to curb and dilute the anti-Duvalierist uprising that was happening. So I think we can expect for some time, Utrice, that we're going to be in uncharted waters politically. Haiti is going to be basically fighting to recoup. And there's a big push, I should say, now from the streets for Martelly and his clique to be judged, to be put on trial for the huge amounts of money they appear to have stolen and misspent and disappeared. There was just a letter put out, I saw today, by the former defense minister, saying people have to bring back their guns and cars that apparently had been given or lent out to Martelly's people. All this stuff has gone missing. So I think we're going to see a big demand for justice going on, a lot like we saw in Guatemala. And the forces of Martelly, those police forces, are ringing his house, preparing for the people that may begin demonstrating outside and asking for him to stand trial and return some of his money. So, you know, it's going to be a very, very turbulent, hot few weeks ahead.
Could you give our listeners an idea of how they can access more information via Haiti Liberté about the developments in Haiti?
Yes. Well, Haiti Liberté, you can, of course, the paper, you can find it on the streets of New York and Miami and Boston and Washington, wherever you find Haitians. But the website is HaitiLiberté.com. That's liberty with an E on the end, .com. And we have articles in English. Most of the articles in the paper are in French and Creole, but there is an English section which gives wrap-ups and summaries. So that can be found online every Wednesday. It's updated, and in fact, we're updating our site shortly so that there will be daily updates on the website.
Thanks, Kim, for this update, and thank you for all you do to get the information out. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Okay, thanks a million, Yatrice.
All righty. We go now to New York, and in New York, there's an issue of a nuclear leak. Paul DiRienzo has been reporting America's Fukushima. It's been a series he's done here on Lead Stories. It's something he has been devoting a substantial amount of time to, and that is recording the actual and looming disasters of America's nuclear program and at America's several nuclear power plants. He's here with us to discuss a radioactive leak into the groundwater beneath the Indian Point nuclear facility in Buchanan, New York, that was found to be 65,000% higher than so-called normal levels. Paul, great to have you with us today.
Hi, Yatrice. Great to be with you.
Well, tell us about this leak, how it came to be known, and give us your version or your understanding of the significance of this in terms of what you've been talking about here on this program about the state of affairs with America's nuclear program.
Sure. Well, thank you very much. Well, at the bottom of this is the fact that America's 100 nuclear plants are aging, and that the government and the owners of the utilities that own these plants have been attempting to extend the licenses of some of these plants as they have expired. Most were given 40-year licenses, mostly in the 1960s and 70s, and those licenses are beginning to expire, and the owners, the utilities, are asking for on average 20-year extensions, and some have been extended up to another 40 years, so we're talking about plants that will eventually have served for 80 years after their construction. The Indian Point plant Buchanan, there's actual reactors at the station. One was closed down because it was unsafe in the 1970s, and the other two were constructed in the 1970s and have both come to the end of their use of their licenses, and the owner Entergy has began the process to restart these licenses. Are you there, Yatrice?
Yes, I am.
Okay, sorry, I didn't know if I left you or not.
I'm paying very close attention.
Great. I didn't know you were there. So, what has happened is that I don't know if we can associate the aging of these plants and the fact that they've reach the end of their license and then that licenses are being renewed with the problems they've been having. But the Riverkeeper, the organization that's a watchdog of conditions at the Hudson River, is definitely wants these plants closed. And the fact is there have been seven malfunctions over the past year since last May. We've talked about them on the show a few times. And the most recent was a leak of tritium. Now, tritium is a radioactive form of hydrogen. It's in water, and it is not the most dangerous, and it's a common product and byproduct of nuclear reactors, but it is limited as far as what you're allowed to release into the environment. And the fact is, it's illegal to allow any radiation into the environment under any circumstances. And of course, since radiation is released anyway, the industry, the utilities, and the government, the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, often have to go into what I would call almost like real contortions to explain why things that are technically illegal are allowed to happen, which is the release of radiation to the environment under any circumstances. And there are folks in Congress who are trying to change the law to allow a minimum amount of radiation to be released into the environment, which in my opinion would be, the industry wants, but in my opinion would be going down a slippery slope. So as far as what happened and how we found out about this leak at the seventh major malfunction that has happened at Indian Point since we started reporting on this last May, well, we don't know for sure. There was samples of water. Well, what the story that's out is that samples of water were taken from a well, three wells out of 40 that were drilled on the property the last time there was a tritium leak, which was in 2005. The government, tritium was released at that time in 2005 into the Hudson, as well as a much more dangerous and pernicious strontium-90, which can cause cancer, was released into the Hudson River. The company Entergy and under NRC, the National Nuclear Regulatory Commission, had to dig about 40 wells, and they dug those 40 wells deep into the bedrock underneath to be able to gauge if there was any release into the groundwater. Three of those wells recently have now tested positive. And what that means, why that is, nobody knows. It shouldn't have happened. There's some original claim that there was some sort of drill, emergency drill was going on, and that a drain overflowed and radioactive water then got into the groundwater. Now the company says nobody's endangered by this. It's still on site. Technically, it's still on site. It's still on their property. These are the ways they get around the regulations to say they're not supposed to release anything, right? It was kept on site, or they drilled a lot of wells to test for it. These are the ways they get around what should be a blanket prohibition of allowing any of this material into the environment at all.
Well, that's been the word out to the public, that there is no need to fear. One, they detected it. Two, they reported it as soon as they detected it. Three, it is in wells that they purposely drilled as a fail-safe measure to show that they constantly are monitoring this. And it has not basically leached into the water supply, the general water supply. So no need, although they're troubled by the 65,000% hike in the so-called acceptable levels, there's no need to worry. All of the safety measures kicked in. What do you say?
Well, that's the problem. There shouldn't have been any leak at all. I mean, all of these things are in lieu of criminal penalties for allowing the leaks to happen in the first place. There is a specific and very, very strict law at the federal level that's been in place since World War II, after World War II, that you're not allowed to release any radiation into the environment. And in fact, radiation is always released into the environment, and nobody goes to jail for it, but they come up with, well, we'll drill 30 wells, and test for it in the future. Well, that's like saying, a bank, well, we'll just make sure, we'll check your house every day to make sure you don't have any money from the bank robbery there, It's like, it already happened. And so that is the problem, is it possible to even have any form of nuclear industry that abides by the basic law that says you're not supposed to release radiation into the environment under any circumstance? So that's one of the big problems, and everything else is sort of like a lot of talk and a lot of hot air, but there's a law that says it shouldn't have happened in the first place. And there's a reason for that law, why even back in the days of the Cold War, they passed laws like that. I mean, because it's well known that there is no safe level of radiation. And to say that there's a safe level of radiation is to forget that one disintegrated, beta particle or alpha particle that hits the wrong cell can cause cancer. It might not do it to a million people, but it could cause one case. And so, there is no safe level. And to say there is a safe level is to say that there's an acceptable level of cancer to be caused by radiation releases into our environment. So we can support this great industry.
Paul, you've been reporting on the status of nuclear plants across the country. You've reported about accidents that have occurred that have not made the headlines. People don't know about them. But you also have been reporting about these sites, nuclear sites, people do not suspect are within the living area. This site, the Indian Point site, is just a couple of miles away from New York City, a major metropolitan area.
But one of the reasons
could you talk in terms of New York, to just localize it there, could you give us an idea of nuclear activity in and around the city of New York?
Sure. Well, the original plan was to build what is today called Indian Point and Gravens, a town called Ravenswood, or a neighborhood, I'm sorry, called Ravenswood in Queens, which is directly across from 68th Street in Manhattan, and it's where today is a gas-fired Con Edison power plant. So the original plan in the 1960s was to build a nuclear power plant in the East River, directly across from 68th Street in Manhattan in Queens. And that would have been the first of many that would have been built next to each other, one next to each other, along the East River all the way down to Brooklyn. And that plan was the first true anti-nuclear movement in America began. And what's funny is that it really began because in those days, people didn't really fully understand the dangers of radiation. They weren't informed. It was secret. It was classified information many times. So they opposed it because it was ugly. It would have been this big, ugly dome and, you know, blocking the skyline view from Manhattan for, you know, millions of wealthy people in Sutton Place, and people lived in Manhattan. And that was actually the rationale for the first anti-nuclear movement, that they were just big and ugly. Later on, people began to understand the inherent dangers of radiation and of course, the possibility we discovered by the late 70s that they could have meltdowns and have catastrophic disasters could happen. And even in the best-run plant, on the best conditions, something could happen that could lead to a catastrophe. Right? And we know that that's possible now. Right, and people should have known it earlier because there was plenty of classified incidents in the weapons program where they knew how dangerous it could be, but they swallowed it because it was for defense. Right, but in the commercial area, you know, you can't really say we need electricity so bad that we should, you know, put up with cancer levels that are way above normal in a community because of the, you know, because of our need for cell phones. I mean, it doesn't sell really to me anyway, and they stopped that, and instead they built the plant in Buchanan, New York's Indian Point 1. But Indian Point 1, which was built in the 60s, was to not have any true safety protections like are required in plants today. So it could possibly run away wild. And it was also very experimental, and they used experimental methodologies and research. And I think I mentioned, the possible connection to thorium research at the old Sylvania Corning Lab in Bayside, Queens, where a piece of metal the size of a golf ball exploded and almost devastated a two-story industrial building and killed somebody and injured 9 people and released radiation into the environment there by Bayside, Queens. And people don't even know that, really. Mostly, who would know that, right? I found the report. To get the report, I had to go to New York State, to Albany, and they sent it to me, and nobody else had read the report in years and years and years. So it's not a known thing. This kind of thing is very common, especially in the development years. Now, today it's more stable. They're supposed to know what they're doing, but these plants are getting older and older and older. And as such, it's, I think, not surprising that they have errors now and function. And now, I'm not saying they're not well-run or the people are dangerous who are running them or that they don't have people who really, you know, care for the safety of the citizens. Of course they do. But, you know, money is the bottom line. And if they build these plants in areas where some of them are, like on Lake Ontario, in remote areas far from civilization or far from towns and villages, then they have to put lines, electric lines. And the electric lines, when you come through Westchester County and Rockland County, the land prices are astronomical. So the Con Ed doesn't want to pay for landlines, power lines. They want to just build their plant as close or have it as close to the city as possible where the consumers are, save all that money and not have to buy property for right away to put in transmission lines. And so they don't really want to have to rely on their plants on Lake Ontario. They would like to rely on their plants near New York City. And Governor Cuomo has taken the position of opposing that. Now, Governor Cuomo's dad, Mario, was famous for closing down Shoreham, which was a nuclear plant they built on Long Island. And the Long Island nuclear plant in Shoreham, you know, was so unsafe. I mean, if you know Long Island, it's a very narrow island, and, you know, a mistake, an error, malfunction would cause a vast amount of people to try and escape and evacuate. And where would they evacuate? On the two roads in the whole area? You know, so, you know, that was a good argument, and it led to Shoreham was built. And then the Long Island Power Company, actually knowing that it would be shut down, powered it up anyway, which made it much more radioactive, and almost as a punishment to the public for being against their idea and making them take down their plant. And so there can be Entergy is not high on the list of, from what I understand, of groups and organizations that are known for doing a good job in running these plants. They're more than the other plants. They're known for cutting corners, you know, and, you know, I'm saying that because somebody who works for the governor's office told me that. So, you know, I don't know personally. I haven't observed or tested their response, but I'm told by somebody who's worked in the governor's office and for other nuclear companies that Entergy has a bad reputation for this kind of thing.
So, Paul, it seems as if the energy industry, especially the nuclear energy industry, has come to a serious fork in the road here. Their plants are aging. And it's really not the kind of business where you could just retrofit and fix it up and patch. It's one of those things where you either decommission the whole thing or you keep going.
Right.
What is your sense of where they're going here?
Yeah, the problem is, and what people who support the continued operation of these plants, which are few and far between, but there are a few of them, and I mean sensible people who think it was, you know, that these plants, if Indian Point is decommissioned like the governor wants, if it does not get relicensed, is not, and the government, the NRC says you have to shut it down, and like Vermont Yankee, which was the people of Vermont, you know, Bernie Sanders, they closed it down and they shipped it out, and they wanted to dump the whole plant, which was just torn down, put into boxes, and shipped to a dump somewhere out west. If they do that with Indian Point, then the replacement would be natural gas. And of course, natural gas is a product of fracking. So people are saying, well, sure, we can, maybe even Governor Cuomo might, you know, see that, if we get rid of this plant, we can, you know, have more of an argument to open up fracking in New York State, which is where it's temporarily but not totally banned. You know, there was a temporary ban that was put in place by the governor, but it could be reversed at any time. And then we could have cheap global greenhouse warming producing natural gas coming from our own lands in New York State, which is then a result of fracking, which is, we could have a whole show on that, you know, the poisonous effect of fracking when they put chemicals into the groundwater, you know, to frack for gas, could have the same as even worse. I mean, some of these chemicals are worse than radiation as contaminants.
How is the industry itself, is what I'm asking, how is the industry itself responding?
They just want to make money. They're in it to make money. I mean, it's all about making money. It's business, like any other business. We're not in was it Andrew Carnegie or someone said, I'm not in the business of making steel. I'm in the business of making money. They have to be regulated. The problem is the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, is an industry lapdog. It's not a true regulator. It's just a really was born in the days of the Atomic Energy Commission as a cheerleader for nuclear power. So how can you have nuclear power's biggest cheerleader, you know, actually regulated as well? And then, you know, as I said, a friend who works for the governor, who worked at one time for the governor, told me it's a headache to him. You know, everybody wants electricity. everybody wants the benefits of it, but nobody wants to be next to a dirty, polluting, energy-producing plant, which they all are in one way or another. And so I say, hey, solar and all the alternative energies, wind, solar, other alternative energies, maybe that is, it's not so unrealistic to say these are the ways to go, because they're the only ways that passively produce electricity from things that are already happening in the earth and don't burn, you know, fuel, whether it's nuclear fuel or gas or oil or coal, and then put all this carbon dioxide or radioactive elements into the atmosphere.
I have to ask you this to respond as an investigative reporter here. So this leak was reported on Friday, Do you think it actually occurred before Friday?
Yes.
Do you think that what has been reported is actually the size of the leak?
Yes.
You think so?
Yes, absolutely. It was reported on Saturday, which is a low news day, right? The governor reported it on Saturday. So whether he's against nuclear power or against his plan or not, it's interesting that he decided to report it on a Saturday, which is the slowest news day and where everybody always reports things they don't want covered, always. And it's almost a measure of that, especially since the testing was done in mid-January, and whatever error happened before that, because the reason they did the testing for it is because they knew there was something bad that had happened. So we don't even know the exact day yet that this event happened. We don't know whatever we know has been released to us long after the event. And, you know, to me, that's political. The governor of New York does not have any real say over this, yet he's always talking about it as if he, you know, is a major spokesperson in this process. But this is totally a federal process. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission does not and often does not listen to the governor of New York or the state they're operating in. They could care less sometimes.
Well, it's reported that he learned about it on Friday, even though he announced it on Saturday. But it was brought to his attention on Friday.
The results of the test. In other words, they knew something happened on some day we don't know. Then they sent that stuff to be tested, and then they got the results of that test, and then they reported the results of that test to all the people they require by law to report it to. Federal and state, and then the governor announced it on Saturday, which is
but
the
doesn't
slowest
it
news.
Itself indicate what the problem is? Something of a magnitude like that, it is a serious breach. It is a serious leak. One would think that the governor, the head of state of the state, would know sooner last Friday.
He ordered the last accident, which was in December, and then there was one before. There's been seven since May, including a very frightening explosion. I was up there near Indian Point talking to people who were there when the explosion happened last spring, and it was frightening. People were saying it was the biggest explosion ever, so they thought it was a nuclear explosion. It was so big. That's when the transformer exploded. Since those days, the governor's ordered his state health department to do an investigation. And environmental department. And the preliminary report deadline is September 15th. So on February 15th, this coming Monday, right? Yeah, on President's Day. So Monday, February 15th, is the deadline for the preliminary report ordered by the governor.
Well, hopefully you'll be on hand to let us know what that report says.
Yes.
Thanks so much, Paul, for being with us today. Thanks for the work you have been doing in this area. And thanks also for making it exclusively available to people here on Lead Stories. I'm referring especially to your America's Fukushima series, an extraordinary series on the state of the United States nuclear program. Thanks again for being with us today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, that brings us to the end of our program today, sobering on both counts, what's happening in Haiti and what's happening in New York. Two entirely different things, but the common thread here is that we should know about these things. They really do matter in our lives. Thanks for joining me. Stay tuned. Right next, coming up, there's Infectious Myth with David Crowe, a great program. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. And I thank you, and I say always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.